We've been away from the book of Job for a couple of weeks, but when we were there, we were talking some about how Job himself walked through the test that came his way, how Job himself walked through the trial sent to him. We've noticed just that part of how he walks through it is he maintains his righteousness. He defends his righteousness. He defends his righteousness against the accusations of the three friends who claim that he has somehow sinned and somehow has gone astray. When we talked of Job's patience, something that he's associated with and known for, and we just noticed that how amidst all of the experience that came his way, amidst all the suffering, amidst all the struggle, amidst all that he's experiencing and thinking, he does not forget, nor does he forsake his faith in God, his hope in God. And kind of every now and then you get popping out these most extraordinary words of trust in God and words of hope in God. I know that my Redeemer lives. He has confidence in God. He knows the way that I take and going to bring me out the other side. And so a lesson for us all, when hurting, when confused, so much so perhaps that you wish you were never born, but even when you're hurting that much, patience, trust in God, hope in Him, wait for Him. And then last time that we were working on Job, we just noticed, and I suggested that an issue that gets addressed for Job himself is the issue of pride. Job was right to defend his righteousness. He was righteous. But he makes himself too high. He makes himself too big. He magnifies himself and exalts himself. He gets out of place. Elihu is mad at him because he's justifying himself rather than God. And so something that happens to Job in the test and in the trial is he learns something about his place. He also learns something about God's place. And that's primarily an issue of dealing with pride, because pride gets us out of place, thinking more highly of ourselves than we ought to think. So we talked a little bit about that as far as one of the issues that comes up in the speeches of Elihu and the speeches of the Lord himself that gets addressed to Job. You know, there's so much more in the book of Job that we could spend time considering and thinking about. It is indeed my favorite Old Testament book for multiple reasons, which I won't list here, except the biggest one. The biggest reason why it's my most favorite Old Testament book is that always lingering in the background, always out there, are the Lord's own speeches from the whirlwind. And like whatever else you think about the book, before you can get to the end of it, you're going to have the Lord himself saying, "Now gird up your loins like a man, stand there, I'm going to ask you and you're going to answer me." That's out there. And I want to just finish Job's side of the story by looking a little bit more particularly and focused on what the Lord says out of the whirlwind to Job himself. Now the book of Job, I mean, it is a book about trials. It's a book about suffering. It's a book about tests of faith. And more specifically, it's about trials that can come to a righteous person. How they happen, what they look like, why they happen, how they should be understood. At the start of the book, Satan clearly incites God to test Job concerning his righteousness. "Does Job fear God for nothing?" This is what Satan asked the Lord. "He doesn't fear you for nothing. He's getting great, great life out of it, great reward out of it." So the enemy raises the question, is Job righteous in order to get the reward of righteousness? So clearly, the enemy incites the Lord to test Job with respect to his righteousness. And that's what the book is about. And then the enemy brings that test of Job's righteousness by inflicting loss, by inflicting suffering. Takes away everything that he has. And most of the dialogue in the book, then, is debate over how the suffering that Job's experience is related to his righteousness, or perhaps to his sin in the view of his friends. And they go back and forth on that. You know, how does righteousness work with respect to suffering? And is it innocent suffering? And what's the purpose of it? And so the theme and the main issues of the whole book are those issues of sufferings and tests and of trials and of righteousness and of sin. So then it's a very remarkable thing that when the Lord himself speaks out of the whirlwind, the main theme, the main issues of the book seem like they're totally neglected, totally ignored. There's no mention of the Lord, of any tests, of any trials, or the things that happen to precipitate the tests. The Lord gives absolutely no advice whatsoever about the experience of suffering or ways that it should be handled. I mean, he doesn't give any grief counseling to Job. He doesn't give Job any strategies on how to handle loss. He doesn't talk to Job about pain management. The Lord says absolutely nothing about Job's righteousness. He also says absolutely nothing about any sins that Job has committed. He doesn't accuse Job of falling short or going astray in any way. There's nothing in the things the Lord says out of the whirlwind about how sin is punished or about how righteousness is rewarded. So the main theme and the main issues of the book at first seem like they're totally ignored and totally neglected by the Lord speaking out of the whirlwind. Have you ever been in a discussion circle? And there always seems like there's one person who seems clueless about what the discussion is about. They seem to be in their own little world, you know, clueless about what everybody else is talking about. And their comments just seem like off the wall. You know, you're all talking about camping, and he's suddenly telling a story about his cousin in Spain. Okay, finish your story and we'll go back to what we were talking about before. At first glance, it seems like that when the Lord speaks from the whirlwind. It looks like he's not aware of what the issue is, you know, or what they've been talking about, you know, what the discussion has been all about. I want you to imagine yourself in Job's shoes. If ever you've had a time in your own life when you felt like you were going through some Job-like experience, maybe in the past or maybe even now, you know, recall that time where you felt, I feel like I'm in the same place that Job is. And I want you to imagine yourself in a place like he was in, where you've suffered some loss, maybe incredible loss. You've suffered some sorrow and some trouble on multiple fronts, maybe on almost every front. You've lost money, lost your job, lost your reputation, lost your network, you know, lots of loss. Maybe you've lost your kids. Maybe you're at odds with your spouse. Maybe friends are drawing false conclusions about you or saying false things about you. Maybe there's lots of physical pain. Maybe there's just physical infirmity. Maybe there's mental anguish. And you've made repeated pleas for God to help you, you know, to answer you. But he's not helping. He's not answering. He's not saying anything to you. So imagine yourself in that kind of place. And then, finally, God answers you out of a whirlwind, speaks to you. But when he speaks to you, he says nothing to explain to you what's going on. He says nothing to advise you about what to do. He says nothing to comfort you, how hard it is or how much it hurts. He says nothing to vindicate you or to justify you or to tell you that you're right. Or he says nothing to tell you kind of like in ways that you might be wrong. He doesn't talk about your sin, doesn't talk about your righteousness, doesn't talk about your sufferings. He says nothing whatsoever about any of the things that have happened to you that have taken place that have put you in the Job-like place. He says nothing at all about that. And instead, he asks you questions. Questions about creation. Questions about the governance and the care of the universe. So at first, you start to hear the questions, you go, okay, I guess we're going to talk about ostriches and thunderbolts and oceans. You know, those are the kinds of things the Lord is bringing up. So I'm going to give you some of the questions that the Lord asked Job out of the whirlwind. If you were in Job's shoes, lots of suffering, lots of pain, lots of anguish, hurting, struggling with it, trying to understand. You know, you've been asking for help. If you were in Job's shoes and you got asked such questions, what would it stir in you? How would you respond? As you hear, you know, the questions, kind of whisper an answer to each question. Just, okay, if I was asked that, this is what I would say. The first question sets the tone for all of the ones to follow. The Lord says, "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth?" Now you get asked some "have you" questions. Have you ever in your life commanded the morning? Have you entered into the springs of the sea? Have you walked in the recesses of the deep? Are you whispering answers? Okay. Have you seen the gates of deep darkness? I'm tempted to comment and throw in little stop and throw in little comments. I didn't even know the deep darkness had gates. But have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you understood the expanse of the earth? Have you entered the storehouses of snow? So you also have to field a few "can you" questions. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades? Can you lead forth a constellation in its season? Can you lift up your voice to the clouds so an abundance of water may cover you? Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, "Here we are"? Can you hunt the prey for the lion? Still giving answers? Can you bind the wild ox in a furrow with ropes? Can you thunder with a voice like God's? Can you draw a leviathan with a fish hook? You receive a few "do you" questions. Do you give the horse his might? Do you clothe his neck with a mane? Do you have an arm like God? And you get questions not just about what you can do and about what you have done. You also get questions about what you know, what it is you understand. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who set its measurements, since you know? Who enclosed the sea with doors? Where is the way to the dwelling of light? In darkness, where is its place? You know. The Lord can be sarcastic, you know. You know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. Who has cleft a channel for the flood, or a way for the thunderbolt? Has the rain a father? From whose womb has come the ice? Who has put wisdom in the innermost being? Who can count the clouds by wisdom or tip the water jars of heaven? Who prepares for the raven its nourishment? Do you know the time the mountain goats give birth? Who sent out the wild donkey free? The old song, like, who let the donkeys out, you know? Is it by your understanding that the hawk soars? So a bunch of questions about what you know and about what you understand. So lots of questions. That's what you hear the Lord saying to you out of the whirlwind when you're in a Job-like type of place. Lots of questions, but all of them have the same answer, basically, don't they? The answer is not me, only God, right? That's the answer to all those questions. And hopefully, if you were indeed whispering answers, I mean, you heard the questions and you gave answers with reference to your own person, to your own situation. But would any of your answers have changed if you were Barack Obama? Any answers changed if you were the President of the United States? How about, would any of your answers have changed if you were Bill Gates? If you had Bill Gates' money, would you have given any different answers to any of those questions? How about if you were Tim Tebow? Would you have changed any answer to any of those questions if you were Tim Tebow? Would any of your answers change if you were more righteous than you are? Maybe you haven't sinned in 3 years. If you were that righteous, would that change any of your answers? Or maybe yesterday they filled up the Rose Bowl and you evangelized it and every one of the people in the Rose Bowl came forward to receive Christ. Would that change any of your answers to any of the questions? Or maybe, what if you were more wicked than you are? Now, what if this week you cheated on your income tax? Would that change any of your answers? Would any of your answers change if you were smarter than you are? Would that change your answers? If you were in the Mensa Society or whatever it's called, do they give different answers to those questions? Or what about if you took a training course? We've got some CDs in the back. If you take that home, it takes about 25 hours to get through it. Take that training course. And then would you give different answers to those questions? In this room, there's different genders. There's different sets of circumstances. There's different ages, different levels of spiritual maturity. We come from different families, parts of different traditions. But is there anybody in the room, though there's lots of differences among us, is there anybody in the room who gave different answers to the questions than you gave? What's the answer to that? No, you suspect everybody gave exactly the same answers, don't you? Okay. So, what is the value of a whole bunch of questions that have God alone as the answer? What's the value of such questions? And what's the value of questions which have the same answer from every person on the whole planet? Not only alive now, but every person who's ever lived on the planet. What's the value of a bunch of questions to which everybody gives the same answer? And the answers aren't that tricky, if you're honest, right? I mean, did you struggle with what your answers would be to any of those questions? You probably got them all right. If you were whispering answers, you probably got 100% right. So it's not like the answers are so hard. And everybody that's ever lived or is living now gives us those same set of answers. a little more pointed, what's the value of such questions, especially for righteous people experiencing trials of their faith, tests of their faith, experiencing sufferings? What's the value of all those questions? I don't know. Or at least it's beyond me, probably, to be able to explain how it works. When I get here, I'm reminded of that proverb that says, there's some things too wonderful for me, and they're all ways. Well, the way that this works is one of those ways. The eagle in the sky, or the ship on the sea, or the man with the maid, or the serpent on the rock. I don't know if I could capture in words how it works. But this I can say. In the midst of great trials, trials of your faith, trials that come to you as a righteous person, suffering for the according to the will of God, to use a phrase from Peter. In the midst of great trials, in the midst of sufferings, very intense suffering perhaps, physical, mental, you know, in the midst of circumstances that are heartbreaking and strength-sapping, if you had the Lord himself ask you questions about wonders and about marvels, you know, wonders of creation, marvels of the universe, great things. If you had the Lord ask you questions about great things, things that are incomprehensible to you, though you know that they exist. Things that are unmanageable by you, again, though you know that they're out there. If you had the Lord ask you about such great things and about such strong things and about such marvelous things, if he asked you about things where they're almost too everything, T-O-O, everything to you, they're too big, they're too strong, they're too large, they're too long ago, they're too far away, they're too high, they're too deep, you know, they're too complex, they're just too everything. If you had the Lord ask you about a bunch of those things, I like it that some of the answers, well, I have to say no to that one because that happened 6,322 years ago and that's a little before my time. So that's why my answer is no to that one. Well, that's a question about stuff that's in outer space, and I haven't been there, so I have to say no to that one. That's a question about something that's just too strong. I don't dare touch that one. So I have to say no to that one. If the Lord came to you and you were in the midst of suffering and trial and struggle, and he asked you about wonders and marvels that are just beyond you, beyond your strength, beyond your capability, but you also knew that they were not too much for him. They were not too big for him. They were not too deep for him. They were not too long ago for him. If he asked you about a bunch of things and you knew the answer to every question was not me, only you, you also knew that anybody else standing in your place, anybody else on the planet, would have to give the same answer. Not me, only you. If that happened to you, you would get through the trial okay. You would. I don't know how it works, but I can tell you, you would get through it. I want to highlight very simply some of the outcomes for Job, some of the outcomes for us, if you ever get a Yahweh out of the whirlwind type of set of questions. Outcome number one, it helps you know your place. The first thing that Job said, as the Lord asked him all this stuff, the very first thing he says, I'm little. You remember, he kind of puffed up, exalted himself, magnified himself, you know, thought he could run with the big boys, wanted to meet the Lord in court. He goes, hearing all those questions, to which I don't have one yes answer, I'm little. I'm insignificant. What can I reply to you? So it helps you know your own place. More importantly and larger, helps you know God's place. Because it suddenly dawns on you, I'm saying no to every question for myself, and the answer for him to every question is yes. And so you say, as Job did, thou canst do all things, and no purpose of thine can be thwarted. It's never beyond him. It was never too early for him, never too late for him, never too high for him, never too deep for him, never too complex for him, never too hard for him. You know, never nothing too much for him. And you realize his every answer is yes. It helps you know what his place is. A set of questions like that also keeps you growing and changing. And Job says in response to the Lord, you know, I thought I had it all together. I thought I was kind of like set. I got my stuff together. He would just show up. I'll just present him with my complete, finished, all-comprehensive case. And we'll see what happens. After that kind of set of questions, Job goes, I will ask and you instruct me. So, okay, I probably could do a little bit more learning and changing and growing. And, you know, you're still ahead of me in a few things. Something like that, right? So it keeps you growing. Keeps you changing. It also somehow opens up places for ministry. Remember, Job had disagreed with his friends, sometimes rather violently. He'd often disdained them. What kinds of friends are you? Everybody knows what you're saying to be true. Duh. You know, you're lousy friends. So he had disagreed with them. And he had disdained them. After he listens to those questions, he prays for them. So he ministers to them. He's a blessing to others. Somehow, hearing all those things from the Lord and saying, not me, but you, release them to a place, or I can pray for these who have to give the same answer to the same questions. I guess I could pray for them. It also puts you in a place where you can receive blessings. It's after that all the fortunes of Job are restored twofold. So he receives blessings from God. He also receives blessings from others. He laments during the course of the discussions about how everybody is, you know, shunning him and staying away from him and avoiding him, not giving him anything. But at the end, here they come. They all got everybody's got a gold piece for them. So it's like they come through the door, hand them a gold coin here. So he's on the receiving end of blessings from people, and of course blessings from God, as God himself doubles everything. And finally, and I hope this sticks with you about the book of Job, it causes the story to end in something beautiful. Remember Job's three daughters? Fairest in the land. Remember their names? A gold coin for remembering their names. Foxy, Chanel, and Mascara. Good looking, sweet smelling, well adorned. You know, it doesn't end simply in being, you know, somebody who's tough as nails and can kick butt or something like that. It ends in something that's beautiful, that looks good, that a sweet aroma, a pleasing aroma, and that's decked out, adorned. Like dressed to the hilt type of thing. It ends in a picture, a story that's beautiful, in a person who's beautiful. And it ends in a perfect ending. He lives 140 years, twice the normal. Jeff Prince isn't here, but he's still got 100 more years to go. He had a birthday party for turning 40 yesterday, so like he got 100 more years yet. 140, sees kids to the fourth generation, a perfect ending. He dies full of days. So I don't know how it works, just the way that it does, but I do know that there isn't any better medicine. That's probably not even the right word. If you're struggling, if you're in the midst of trials, you know, if you're struggling to understand and hurting deeply, wondering how you get through this, I'm not dismissing all the discussion or all the rest of the book, but the thing that has to crown it all and that will close it is the Lord Himself. And He's probably going to not talk about things that you think you ought to talk about. He's not going to talk about you or managing your struggles or explain to you why it happened or the issues involved and deep explanation. And he's going to ask you questions to which you're going to say, I wasn't there. No, can't, no, never have, don't know, don't understand that, I didn't even know, I didn't have a clue what you're talking about, no, and at the same time saying, but you know, you were able, you did that, you understand that, you control that, and that somehow will work in you, what's my place? What's His place? It will cause you to know, let me ask you, you instruct me. It'll say, lots of other people in the same boat as I, giving the same answers, I'll minister to them using whatever grace and gifts you've given to me. You can be a blessing. You can also receive blessings from the Lord and from others. And it'll make you a beautiful person with a beautiful story and a perfect ending. Somehow that will come from that encounter. So I hope that touches you. Again, the greatness of it is beyond me. I don't pretend to comprehend the incomprehensible. But I hope you touch those kinds of things with your God, with our God. And sometimes that He would come to you and say, okay, gird up your loins like a man. And you've been shooting your mouth off, kind of like, my turn. I'm going to ask you, and you instruct me. First thing that you'll say after a few questions is, I'm little. I'll be right next to you saying, I'm little too. Kind of like, high five between the little people, you know? And the next thing we'll turn to each other and say, you know what? Our God can do all things. There is nothing that's impossible for Him. No purpose of His can be thwarted. He does all things well. So I hope that happens to you. Talk about a life-changing experience. There's one of them. Never leaves you the same.